Today, we want to focus on the role of the stranger in our lives. We want to focus down more on our own involvement and the way society is today and how we approach it from a religious perspective. Just in summary, if I can remember what I said, by the way, you know, I write notes. I don't have a terrible time reading them. In fact, one of my pastimes is to go back and read my old sermons and things that I've written in hand, longhand. And fortunately, my wife, after 42 years of marriage, that was 2 years ago, finally got me a computer, so I can now use a computer, but I didn't bring it with me. But anyway, one other thing about that, about 4 or 5 years ago, this little town in southern Idaho, Middleton, Idaho, we had our high school, school reunion for about, we'd had, our class, we'd had about three people. But so we had a whole segment of people, and lo and behold, who should show up but my first grade teacher. And I said to her, my family has something against you because apparently you failed to teach me penmanship in the first grade. But I said, I'll forgive you. You're okay. At any rate, getting back to the topic at hand on the role of the stranger in our lives and a little bit of the review. In other words, Nesbitt, in his book, his thesis is that there has been a decline of closely knit, authority tradition-guided local kinds of community. And the agent in doing this has been largely the role of the state with its great bureaucracies. It has resulted in an extreme individualism, which has several different manifestations, as is portrayed in the book that I talked about yesterday by Robert Bella and several others, called Habits of the Heart. And I would recommend that to be read also. And you can buy, at least I saw a few copies in the bookstore, but everybody should have this book, The Company of the Strangers, right? I mean, if you want to be well informed about community. So, anyway, we had to buy one here because we have either sold or given or have taken from us these Habits of the Heart. At any rate, so that depicts in very careful detail the kind of individualism we have. As I recall, I said the religious individualism coming out of the gospel and the importance of the individual, heavily influenced by Martin Luther and other contemporary Protestant theologians. Individualism of the Republic, going back all the way to Greece, when they had a democracy carried over through American Constitution and those who formed it. Those are two forms. The third is utilitarian individualism, which has its origin, I understand, in John Locke and the theory of contract, and that the whole situation of individuals is that we are individuals out here, right? We were created as individuals, and as individuals we come together in contracts, right? And so the individual is the ultimate, like the atomic theory of, you know, of life, that we're little atoms and we associate together. So that's the John Locke theory, which has come down in its more crass form in what he calls utilitarian individualism, which is a contractual individualism where the individual is supreme and is heavily involved in the world of business, where the dollar, the bottom line, is the ultimate test of all values. Fortunately, none of these are pure examples. we have it all in our own selves. But these are the form. And the fourth, which Bella says is the most serious, it troubles him the most, is what he calls expressive individualism, which is individualism of the individual, of where the only authority is the person themselves, their feelings, their experiences, their desires, and in which any kind of moral context of life no longer exists. And we find that in the touchy and feely, the organization development, and other kinds of things. He calls it therapeutic individualism. So we have those four, and that is the way individualism manifests itself today. Bella says that the first two, the from our Puritan and religious heritage, is healthy and needs to be revived, but it's on the way. Same way the Republican individualism is on the way, and the other two seems to be in ascendance. But this is the end result of this alienation of the large bureaucracies that we have developed in the state, which tend to make a person feel that they have no power, they have no determination of their own destiny, and the individual is lost in a mass society. Also, the modern urban metropolis, with its associational kind of relationships, is also a part of it, and resulting in the alienation for people from institutions, from the goals of the society, from other people, and ultimately from God. So that's the seriousness of the breakdown of community, the sense of authority, the sense of belonging, the sense of tradition in our society. It leads to a society, as someone was saying earlier, and that even a church tends to not even no longer believe in the God that was the origin of it. So, now this has resulted in the problem of, and I might say in the expression of individualism, also religious piety and kind of personal religion, of which many of us, I'm sure, were reared, I certainly was, personal piety, where the individual is the ultimate thing, and there's no sense of responsibility for our neighbor, no sense of responsibility for society. So this is a kind of a morass in which we find ourselves, of extreme individualism, where the sense of solidarity as a people, as a nation, as communities, has been to a great extent lost. Therefore, the issue that Parker Palmer, in his book *The Company of the Stranger*, wants to address is the issue of the public. What to happen? What to do with the public? His book is entitled *The Company of Strangers: Christians and the Renewal of America's Public Life*. So that is the task. How can we renew public life in a society that has lost much of its sense of public responsibility, or have given it to someone else and feels alienated and lonely? I was reading not too long ago an article in the Dallas, that's not the right pronunciation, but on family. It was different articles on family. And this French sociologist said, we live extremely isolated lives. We live in a little single family dwelling or in an apartment. When we go to the store, we get in a little encapsulated vehicle that's often, if we need it, air conditioned. We drive usually by ourselves to the mall. We go into the mall, where everything is predicated on selling us something, or selling us, you know, and it's not personal at all. There's no public issues that take place in malls. In fact, the one we have in the Bellevue Square, for many years there were even, the man who owned it, one time even threw a woman out bodily. She sued him, fortunately. And so, what I'm trying to tell you, and then we get back in this little encapsulated thing, which we have no contact with anybody else. We drive back home, and we sit down, and we turn on this tube that is certainly not personal, right? So to a great extent, and if we join a church, it's usually one that's pretty much like ourselves. We join a club, it's one that's pretty much like we are, and we never ever run into a different and diverse world and strange. In other words, the stranger is not there. So that's a problem that he is seeking to deal with. So here's what he says. His concern is that American individualism is destroying public life. I'll tell you, I'm going to have to go to Arizona. I have a little allergy. He says public life is an arena of spiritual experience. This is his affirmation. Public life is an arena of public of spiritual experience, a setting in which God speaks to us and forms our hearts with words we cannot hear in the primate realm. If we deprive ourselves of public experience, we deny ourselves a unique and compelling sort of communication with God. Without public experience, we cannot experience the fullness of God's word for our lives. Now that's something to ponder for quite a while. If we deprive ourselves of public experience, we deny ourselves a unique and compelling sort of communication with God. Without public experience, we cannot experience the fullness of God's word for our lives.
I think the humorous and philosopher Will Rogers said it right when he said, "I know no strangers, only friends I have never met." And I think that's a good philosophy.
That is a good statement. If only the world saw it that way, right? We wouldn't be over in Iraq. We wouldn't, you know, a lot of things wouldn't be happening. Predicate it, give it a little biblical, since we're Methodists and Lutherans and Episcopalians and whatever. We want a scriptural basis for our understanding. And I would doubt, and I'm really drawing heavily from chapter 3, The Company of the Strangers by Parker Palmer, The Spirituality of Public Life. I'm reading, quoting some from it because it was for me, when I read it, an eye-opener. I mean, it was a new insight. It was a new way of looking at life. And looking at life in a spiritual perspective. So what he does is quotes from the book of Hebrews, and I'm sure these are familiar words, but never fully understood them. He says, "Let brotherly love," we would add sisterly as well, "love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware." And the reference of this story goes back to the 18th chapter of Genesis, where you recall some strangers appeared to Abraham and Sarah at their tent in Hebron and are welcomed, offered refreshment and rest. The strangers then announced that Sarah, who is well past childbearing age, shall give birth to a son, who is Isaac, the second patriarch of the Hebrew people. And as the story unfolds, it becomes clear that these visitors are angels of the Lord, messengers sent to convey and fulfill God's promise to Abraham. The promise that Abraham will be given many descendants and that they will be given the land. Now, says Parker Palmer, had Abraham and Sarah not been willing to meet the strangers openly and in good faith, they might have blocked the promise from being fulfilled. And then he quotes another from the Old Testament to the New Testament, I'm in proper perspective here. He says that this same theme is struck in the 24th chapter of Gospel according to Luke. And here the story is set just after Jesus' crucifixion. The women go to the tomb and find it empty. They report this fact along with the prophecy that Jesus would be resurrected to the apostles, who react with skepticism. These words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. A little later, that day, two of the apostles were walking along the road to Emmaus when they met a stranger. The stranger asked them why they seemed downcast, and the apostles tell them of Jesus' death and of their doubt, and that he had been truly resurrected. That their doubt that he was truly resurrected. But the stranger says, "O foolish men and slow of heart to believe all the prophets have spoken. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, 'Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent.' So he went in to stay with them. And when he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And he was known to them in the breaking of the bread." And so Parker Palmer comments, he said, "That stranger, of course, was a risen Christ. That the apostles failed to extend hospitality to the stranger, they might not have learned that the promise of the resurrection had been fulfilled." That is really, I think, a very powerful story, two powerful stories, which that a stranger may be an angel unaware, and that a stranger that you meet might be actually, in a real sense, to Christ. So in all these stories, the strangers is a barrier of the truth, which might not or otherwise have been received. But the stories tell us that our everyday perceptions and assumptions must be shaken by the intrusion of strangeness if we are to hear God's word. Now that's a kind of a powerful thing to kind of put your mind around. And I tend to get carried on here, but what is your own experience in this regard when you think about it?
Would you repeat that last
story? I will. I said, the stories tell us that our everyday perceptions and assumptions must be shaken by the intrusion of strangeness if we are to hear God's word.
What comes to me is, I think I've always been, as our family was a little community, I was very protective of that little community and wanting all that special time. And then when we went, we're called to South Africa, I found ourselves in a whole different situation where our home became a place for many strangers. All of a sudden there was a young person who we were asked to take in because they needed shelter. And sort of fell into something that I'd always been protective of our privacy and that sort of thing. And found that this intrusion, which I thought at first might be an intrusion of strangers into my home, became a blessing and became a way of helping me to understand that community was a very special thing in these strangers that ended up being part of the family. And what I thought was an intrusion was really God sent. And it's interesting to see how that opens up a whole new world of blessing.
Right. Any other feelings about it?
God is in us all. So when you meet a stranger, you are in fact meeting God. So you can't help but gain from your meeting.
But in a large city, you must be aware of the fact that strangers are often criminals, and you have to protect yourself. And so you kind of put a wall around yourself, and if you go shopping, you don't speak to strangers because that might open up a very bad experience. And so it's different from when you live in a small town. In a large city, you are always aware of the fact that there is crime and that you must protect yourself. And I wondered how that man would speak to that.
Well, he doesn't really speak to it, but I think all I would say that discretion is important.
He speaks in the very first, I'm not far into the book, but he encounters this taxi driver, and yeah, this taxi driver says, hey, it's exciting, and sometimes it's dangerous, but it's...
That's right. And that is dangerous.
It is the public.
And more taxi drivers are killed, yeah.
Well, some of you here know my background, but many of you don't, others don't, but I'm a Baton Kerrigan veteran, survivor of the death march. And I give thanks to God daily for that, because it made me a different person. It strengthened my faith. And I have a philosophy of life now that I wouldn't have if I hadn't gone through that. And I think that's the meeting of strangers too. Right. Strangers being enemies and so forth. So
I don't know if any of you were here the other day when a young girl had matins, and she shared with us, she had been in, I can't say it the way they say it, Nicaragua. They say it beautifully.
Nicaragua.
Anyway, she talked about how she hitchhiked down there to get from one place to another, and how she felt safe doing it down there to a great degree. And so when she came back, she could not resist picking up a hitchhiker. And she came upon a hitchhiker and she picked him up. And he got into the car. She felt leery, but she felt this was a risk she wanted to take. He had his hand in his pocket, and it was bulky. And she thought, gun. And she went a little farther, and every time he moved, she became uncomfortable. And she couldn't resist asking him to take his hand out of his pocket. And he was a crippled. He had a crippled hand. And so this too, I think, is an example. I lived on church property once, and we had all kinds of people stop by there. And they claimed that they belonged to a certain Lutheran church back in the Middle West, and they needed $25 to get to San Jose and stuff like that. And a lot of the stories I didn't believe, but then I think it did something for me. It's not to me to really know that. If I give freely, what he does with it is his problem, not mine. And so I feel that changed me, and in a way, meeting strangers like that, to me, helped me. Because I know a lot of towns now have gone to working through the Red Cross, or the Salvation Army. One of the churches in our town becomes the Salvation Army, and If anybody comes to the church, we send them to the Salvation Army to be helped. Sometimes because the pastor can't resist giving them all money, you know, and things, and those reasons. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if those are valid reasons or not. I really don't. I know it changed me and my feeling of my giving.
Right. Well, that is, as I say, all this is really an attitude. But every attitude you have toward people, it must be done with a sense of, you know, true knowledge. But at any rate, this has been our experience. He also says all these stories that there is the truth that the promise that God will continue to move among us and within us, bringing forth fresh vitalities and new possibilities of life. In other words, God is continually revealing himself, herself, to us. And if we have eyes and ears to hear, it's that if we are capable of receiving the stranger. If not, says Parker Palmer, the result is isolation. People live in isolation. They become bored, boredom. It's very prone in our technological, large, bureaucratic society. And we retreat further and further, he says, into private life. The private is the realm of the familiar. The public is the realm of the novel and the strange. Boredom, this was to me kind of an interesting aside, but it's very important. He says, boredom may seem to be a strictly personal, private problem. But he said it is finally a public concern. For boredom breeds violence in people, violence as people strike out to find something that will quicken the pulse, something which will make them feel alive again. And we know now that one of the primary problems in our urban environment, well, the whole world, but certainly in our environment, is violence of individuals against individuals, men against wives and vice versa, parents and children, different groups and so on. Great violence in the world today. So violence against a stranger, so common in our day, comes partly from our fear of all things strange. Now, as in our little discussion already, you begin to express some of the things that create fear for you. And like living in a large city, going down a particular street, especially if it's dark, you become very fearful of all kinds of things that might happen. And your story, the person or the girl who saw the man's hand in his pocket, mm-hmm. and your imagination created a gun, right? And we all have anxieties and fears of other people. And if we were honest with ourselves and could share some of these fears, honestly, you see, because we don't want to, we want to talk like we're loving and open people, but we're very fear-ridden, and part of it is due to our isolation, each from the other. Well, I was going to say also, in our present situation, several years ago, well, it seems like I never intended it, but I've been to the Near East on 3 occasions. The first occasion, I was simply after the Seven-Day War in 67, we were in Europe, and I went over and did a little touring around just after the Seven-Day War. Went into the old city and all that. Then, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I went over with a tour of the National Council of Churches, the American Jewish Community, and we visited with the Coptic Christians in Cairo. We went to Damascus and met with the small remaining Jewish community and all kinds of people. And then, about 9 years ago, I got a request through the Palestinian people, locally, people like me, to go with four other clergy, a rabbi, a very close friend of mine, and they said, I've been invited to go to meet with the Palestinians. He said, well, he said, the Jewish community won't like it. But he said, I suggest that you pull together the people going with some Jewish leaders and we talk about it so you'll be informed. So a week before we were to go, we had a meeting in the Church Council of Greater Seattle. And my friend and some other Jewish leaders that I knew very well met with the Christian leaders. And in all my life, I have never been so beset upon. And they said, you're going to deal with the PLO, who are like the Nazis, and Arafat, who is like Hitler, right? So, I mean, I had some feelings myself. I mean, I had some feelings about Arabs, and we have a whole stereotype group of ideas in America about Arab people, right? And it's not very positive. And even we have some attitudes toward Jewish people, too. But, so we were a little kind of stubborn. We said, well, we had gone, a lot of Christian ministers had gone to Jerusalem to talk with the Israeli leaders, and so we must respond to the Palestinians. So we did. We spent 9 or 10 days in Beirut. When I think about it, I cringe, frankly, because there was no police force, no fire department, nothing. It was a free city without any kind of controls. And you know, you could have been taken hostage, you could have been shot, and I didn't know any better. So so we visited with the refugee camps, the hospitals, the various social institutions that the Palestinians had developed. Got to know several of them very well. And when we came back, I'd been back about a day, and we didn't check signals or agree some common statement. I got a call from a TV station, wanted to do a live, you know, live, whatever it is. And the question was, what do you think about the Palestinians and Arafat and so on? And so I said, I think the Palestinians need to have their own state. I said, the PLO is a legitimate expression, organizational expression of the Palestinians, and that Arafat is not a radical, but he's a politician, he's a moderate. And he meets, he was meeting quite regularly with the head of the Presbyterian Church in that part of the world. So, all of a sudden, I, through meeting with this stranger, see, these strange people I've never known, all of a sudden I had some friends. It was a different world. It also changed my own relationship to the Palestinians and to the whole situation. But what bothers me right now, which led me to say this, is I am very much concerned about all the hoopla on the Iraqis and all that. I mean, we can develop if we're not very careful. A lot of hatred, a lot of stereotypes, a lot of making enemies out of people. And our own political leaders and the mass media are very prone to do that. And if you read back over the materials written at the time of every world war or every war, there was always a lot of propaganda, real propaganda by the leaders of the state that always they thrived on the stranger. So that's kind of my experience of that. In Hebrews 11, he quotes, we feel at home when we can, when we stay, you know, see, I can't remember, when we stay within our enclave, surrounded and protected by people. If our own kind, of our own kind, if we feel exile when exposed to the larger society with all its pluralism and variety, we yearn some of the time for an earlier time, The enclaves were very secure when people stayed in their place. So isn't that where we are in our society today? We find ourselves, I mean, my whole career, I've been a church council executive for 37 years, and the last 20 years especially, I find myself being sensitized to new groups of people, you know, to new groups of people. I recall when I, in the 60s, it was the black people and the civil rights movement. In the 70s, it was with the gay community. All of a sudden, they became friends, no longer strangers, but friends, sources of great insight and strength and beauty. You can go on and on. The Native Americans, especially, another experience where becoming friends, you didn't help them, but they certainly did help you. So that's the kind of thing we have. In fact, Farmer says, could we not see in our own situation in the same light? Is it not possible that the social upheavals of our day, our own sense of exiles on earth, are God's ways of calling us into a new future away from the divisions of the past toward a holy city? I had a couple experiences myself, which I related. I gave a speech at the annual meeting of the National Association of Ecumenical Staff. You all heard about that. But it's an association of people like myself. And I was supposed to tell them, because I just retired, and I was supposed to tell them what they should do, what should be their style of ministry as a church council executive. And so I began to list all these things that I thought were important. And right at the top of the list, I put down being vulnerable. Vulnerable. We must be vulnerable to the world. And that we must allow people to walk in our door or in the door of our life because they have something to say to us. And as the scriptures say, that this something could be of God. There's a couple of illustrations of that. And I'll quit. Oh, my goodness, I'm talking too long. But I think these are interesting stories because they have some significance. One day, a young Filipino woman walked into my door. This was 8 years ago. And I had heard about her brother, and his friend, who were cannery workers, Filipino cannery workers in Seattle, had been killed and shot, assassinated on the spot. And she told me that it was their belief that these had been assassinated by agents agents of Marcos. And would I be willing to bring this concern to the church council and be supportive of them? And I thought to myself at the time, this problem is too big. International problem? I mean, how can I do anything about it? I better send her next door. But I took it to the council. The council agreed to stand behind the Domingo Viernes. And through a period of 8 years ago, culminating last December, you may have read about this, and the Domingo, and we had a very personal involvement in it, because this young woman eventually came on the board of the church council, is now the secretary of the council. We have a daughter who just became a lawyer, was in her, just before she passed the bar, worked on the case as a legal aide, so we were quite involved in it. And they actually won an indictment, a judgment against Imeldo and Ferdinand Marcos of $15.1 million. This was just because I opened the door to this young woman and talked to her and said I would help her. I didn't do much. I'd go to press conferences or put my name on sheets of paper or stuff like that. So it opened the door to a whole kind of relationship with an Asian community that has been significant. On the 4th of July this year, and we never had many personal, we had some, but not many personal friends that were Asians. But we had that, my daughter, one daughter, and Cindy, me with this young girl. But on a party in our home on the 4th of July for our daughter, Rebecca, who just became a lawyer. And we had the strangest combination of people you've ever seen. I mean, there were Asian people, black people, all kinds of people.
Because celebrating the 4th of July.
Celebrating the 4th of July. And, you know, tall heads, and brown heads, and red heads, and every kind of head, all sizes. And I thought, now this is America. This is opening the door to the stranger. The other experience, and since I'm a teacher, I'll take advantage of it. The other story is somewhat similar. When I came to Seattle, one of the first problems in the Puget Sound that hit me straight in the face was the situation of Native American Indian fishing rights. The fact that these rights were their rights, but we had tried to deprive them of the rights because the rights were the result of a treaty agreement in which I think the Indians really got the worst of the deal. But anyway, we worked with them for a long, long time and stood with them on the Judge Bolt decision, which was a Supreme Court decision that gave them this half of the salmon. But it will be 3 years ago now, Jules Praying Wolf James of the Lummi Indians wrote me a letter, I knew him, said that he thought it would be a good idea if the bishops, the denominational heads, I worked with them on a very regular basis, we would meet every year for a retreat, if they would apologize to the Native American people for the way they had treated Native American traditional religion. As you know, that we in the, if you read this book that we published a couple years ago, Roots and Branches, it tells you the story of how the state tried to destroy Native American religion and made a Native American culture, and the church too often was in cahoots with them. But anyway, he wanted us to apologize for our involvement as a church, so I took it to the bishops. The chair of our Native American task force is a very capable young Lutheran pastor, Reverend John Magnuson. And the bishop said, yes, we would like to try to do something. So John, who is a kind of a mystic, is a mystic. Do you know John?
Yeah, okay. I'm
a
janitor in the building.
Yeah, well, John is a mystic. So John doesn't do things by rational, technical ways. He goes, so he decided he would write it in a sacred burial ground down in New Mexico. And out in, the, in this, so he said the spirits could surround him. And he wrote this beautiful, I thought it was poetic, beautiful statement. We took it to the bishops and we had four sessions with them because the first draft said, we are ashamed. No, they just couldn't bring themselves to say we're ashamed. Finally they said, we apologize. And they apologized for the way they had dealt with the Native American religion. And they said, we ask your forgiveness and your blessing. And it was a beautiful statement. It detailed certain things that the Christian church would do in standing with and protecting Native American religion. Well, that didn't last long. Within 6 or 8 months, we got this request from the Lummi Indians that they had an ancient burial ground on Madrona Point on Orcas Island, which the Northwest Development Company with Norton Clapp owns it. As those of you from this part of the country know that Norton Clapp is probably the wealthiest man in the state, the most powerful man in the state, and his stepson is the governor. So he's got all bases covered. So that we were to somehow enter into this situation and saved that helped save that paragraph. And again, I had that feeling of, boy, nothing we can do about this one, you know. We take on the mayor, sure, or the governor himself, but Norton Clapp, that's like it's approaching God. So we said, we'll see what we can do. So we got all our facts together, and our task was to get the Norton Clapp to talk again with the Lummi Indians. And we met with him on a couple occasions, and thing is all signed and delivered, and they've talked enough, and the caterpillars are going to roll on the Dorner Point come April. This was January. So we did what church people can do. We held two prayer vigils at the same time, one on Madrona Point with the Native Americans and the island people. Also we had a vigil with the bishops and all mission heads and the Native Americans before the Norton Clapp's building in Seattle. And it was an issue that all of a sudden caught the imagination of the people, and the press picked it up, and it was on, and some fellow from Atlanta, see, the issue was, were the Indians truly buried in this Madrona Point? Oh, I'm out of time. We're at dinner time. But at any rate, to make a long story short, which is a really interesting story, we had this thing, and all of a sudden, April came, and I even offered the Archbishop Hunhausen to mediate, the Catholic Archbishop, to mediate this whole situation. Nothing to it. So April came, and the machinery did not roll. July came, and the machinery did not roll. And God acts in strange ways. William Randolph Hearst, the second or third, heard about it. Not the one that writes in the PI in Seattle area all the time. Lord forbid, but his son, Patty Hearst, just a brother, apparently became interested in this, and he hired the best negotiating lawyer in the state of Washington to negotiate the deal. And finally, in this past January, Norton Clapp got $2.2 million from the federal government, from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Indians got their burial ground preserved, and the islanders got a beautiful new park. Now, the point was that we entered in, not in a great public way, but in a way because we listened to the people, and God did work. Okay? We didn't finish everything I wanted to say, and we'll talk again, what, tomorrow? Okay, that's it. I'm sorry for that.